Welcome to the Dream Freedom Beauty Podcast.
Brian Stafford left his 20-year career as a psychiatrist to become a wilderness guide and agent of human and cultural transformation. He completed the intensive training as a psycho-spiritual wilderness guide with the Animas Valley Institute, founded by Bill Plotkin. Now Brian guides individuals to the place they most long and fear to go, their soul place and purpose. Brian guides primarily in Ojai, California. In this episode, we discuss Bill Plotkin's book Soulcraft, and Brian shares how he made the dramatic transformation from psychiatrist to wilderness guide, how his wife reacted to his shift in values, focus, and lifestyle, and Bill Plotkin's view of how our ego can grow to support our soul as the guiding force in our lives.
We're your hosts, sisters Natalie
and Lizzie Ross.
Dream Freedom Beauty is a podcast for free spirits who yearn to connect deeply with their intuition and manifest their dream lives in harmony with the earth.
You can find the podcast show notes at dreamfreedombeauty.com. Welcome to the show, Brian. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
And we're going to take a second to just take a few deep breaths. Natalie and Brian and me, Lizzie, and all of our listeners, get into your body, relax, and invite whatever guidance you'd like to into this space. And if you have any intentions to set, go ahead and let them become clear. And just let me know when you're ready.
Ready.
All right. So welcome, Brian. Thank you again. You were an academic pediatrician and a psychiatrist, seemingly deeply immersed in the academic world. And now you're a psycho-spiritual wilderness guide. What happened to bring about this dramatic change in your lifestyle and focus?
Quite a bit. as you can imagine, I was living the American medical dream, if there is such a thing, and pretty happy in academics and successful in terms of what academics want, which is research and publications, but also in what was important to me, which was serving individuals who are having mental health issues or at risk for that, and primarily in vulnerable populations that were minorities or impoverished. And about maybe 20 years into that journey, kind of got to the top of my career, kind of probably 20 years before you're supposed to. And one night I heard a voice say, "You're done."
Wow.
And I was like, what? It's like an authentic voice, like one of those biblical voices that you read about when you're a child, right?
Yeah.
What were you, were you like washing the dishes or were you asleep? Like what?
No, I was in bed.
You're in bed.
Yeah, I was in bed and it was a powerful voice. I did not want to listen to it. It was kind of like, I think in the Old Testament, right? Jonah decides to go the other way and has to be going to the belly of a whale then because he's refusing the call. It's like, what are you talking about? I'm at the top of my career, got a beautiful house and a beautiful wife and a, you know, two kids and all those kind of things. And I quite wasn't ready to let that go. It was safe, secure, and full of privilege and power and the ability to do good. And but there was also other things missing. I think for a long time I had talked about, and I wasn't really paying attention to myself, but sometimes you speak and others are paying attention. I'd been using the word like soulless, S-O-U-L-L-E-S-S. There's just something seemed like so much of medicine was business, actually, and had to do with computer screens, and that there was something soulless about that, and I had felt that. And I think through my training also in psychiatry, I had tried to find something sacred about psychiatry in terms of people's stories and a deeper story. But modern psychiatry is not so much about that, certainly very rarely in academics, if at all. And most psychiatrists actually don't believe, I would say, in some sort of spiritual realm at all, or have any spiritual practice. That's shifting now that mindfulness has kind of moved in as a therapeutic technique. Mm-hmm. But this voice was pretty clear, and I was somewhat resistant, and knew that something was going to end. And I thought, okay, well, maybe it's psychiatry, maybe it's academics. It could be something bigger. It could be like my marriage. It could be my relationship with consumer culture or Western culture. And I wasn't really sure. And so I went to see my chair of my department and said, you know, I need a sabbatical because I think I'm kind of done.
Wow. So how did you get from hearing that voice in that moment of resistance? That's pretty brave and quick for you to take action on.
Well, it wasn't right away. It took a while, and it took other parts of my life kind of beginning to tremble, maybe would be the right way to say it. The house is like shaking at its foundations, and it's like wanting you to say yes to the authentic voice. And through that, and it was kind of a conversation, it's like, I don't really know if I'm here to do this the rest of my life, which is really threatening to people who've kind of made that commitment to stay in one profession their whole life. And so she suggested I take a sabbatical. And I thought that sounded like a good idea. I was primarily a perinatal and infant psychiatrist, which means as a man, you're working with colleagues who are women and patients primarily who are women. And so I knew that something was missing about the masculine. Mm-hmm. I had some friends who were kind of interested in similar spiritual things, and they were in Boulder, which is actually quite a trek away from Denver where I was practicing. And so I signed up for something I found on the internet called a men's rite of passage. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. It was through a group called the Lumen. And it was originally founded by a Father Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R, who's I think he's a Franciscan educator in Santa Fe. I signed up for that, even though I wasn't identifying as Christian or Catholic, or certainly didn't really think Texas was going to be that pretty. But the passage was at Texas in the Hill Country.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's rather powerful, actually. I felt like authenticity come through and an emotional opening up to things that I had probably tried to push away for a while. And then at the end of that program, I think it was like 3 days, there was a handout, and it was something like Tools for the Masculine Spiritual Journey. And it was a list of books and websites and other things like that. And about halfway down the list, there was this book, Soulcraft, by Bill Plotkin. And I thought, oh, there's that word soul again that I've been using, not thinking that it really exists as a scientist. And I downloaded that book in the San Antonio airport on my e-reader. And by page 10, I was kind of like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
What is this? If this is the way the world is, the way that he writes about the world, that's the world I want to live in. It was a deep, deep resonance, and I was filled with, I'd say, hope, grief, and skepticism, something like that.
A healthy mix of things.
Yeah.
And all the different voices, the one that wishes that the world was enchanted, grief that if the world is enchanted, I've missed out for a long time, and skepticism that, you know, maybe there is really nothing deeply spiritual in the world and deeply connecting and deeply guiding your life and for your own guidance, but also for service to the world, something like that. So it's kind of a mix of all that. And got back home to Colorado and still on sabbatical. I had a couple more weeks, and I signed up for a program with the Animas Valley Institute. And it was not guided by Bill Plotkin, but by some of the other wonderful guides. And it was an 8-day backpacking program in kind of the canyonlands of Southeast Utah. And the first night it was raining and cold and the wind was blowing, and I thought, what have I done here? 7 degrees out here in May.
So enchanting.
Yeah.
And I had a dream that night that just cracked me open, actually. And the rest of the program was also profoundly conscious shifting. And I just thought, what world is this? I have not encountered this world. And it's very similar to what he wrote about in the book. And
so what was it about that world that you recognized as different from your prior experience?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll share the dream and maybe we'll.
Yes, I'd love to share it.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So in this dream, I'm in a classroom, and in the classroom, there's, you know, like 30 other students. I'm about, I don't remember exactly the age I was, but I wasn't, in my 40s, which is when I had this dream. I was a little bit younger, and it seemed like there were lots of other students in there, and we were at our desks, and in the front there was a teacher, and it was kind of like a didactic where the teacher would ask a question, and then whoever could answer it would stay in, kind of like a spelling bee. Mm-hmm. And this went through several rounds, and others kept dropping out, and I always had the right answers, and that paralleled kind of the way I felt in my life. I always had a lot of good answers, was pretty smart, well-read. And kind of, that's kind of how I got moved up through the system, as I had this ability to kind of figure things out and how things work well. And so the dream didn't feel that different. And it's coming to the end where the teacher's just asking me the questions because I'm the one with the answers, right? Mm-hmm. And then finally, when everyone else has kind of dropped out of the scene, she looks at me and she says, "Now for the most important question of your life."
Wow.
And then she says, "We get syzygy." And I was like, "Excuse me, did you sneeze?" She said it again, "We get syzygy." And I was like, "I don't know what you're asking. Is this... Can you use it in a different way? Is there a different explanation for this?" And she repeated it one more time.
Wow.
And I was obviously beginning to panic because this is not just, you know, how to win the classroom prize. It's the most important question of your life. And I woke up in a panic. And I knew right then that I did not know the language of soul,
ooh, actually.
Because I think that was always what was under the surface, probably ever since my 20s, was, is there a soul? And if so, how does one find it? And how does one live it in a place where psychiatry doesn't even believe in soul or spirit? And the church that I grew up in certainly didn't have the same concept that kind of equated soul and spirit, and didn't really feel like people knew what this was. And then to have, be faced with this question just cracked me open right there. It's like, oh boy. Now we're in it.
And I love how the soul has a, to me, there's a sense of humor in that we get syzygy, you know, it's this confounding coyote energy again.
Totally. Right. And there was an intuition, obviously, that I knew I didn't know the language of soul, and the terror that maybe that's the most important question is, how does one speak or listen to the language of soul? And, you know, through the rest of that week in the canyon, more dreams came and more synchronies and omens and signs and strange things happening with creatures on the land. And then I went home, and about a week later, I was in a public library, just kind of like, oh, I'll read a little bit about Carl Jung. And as I'm reading in one of the opening chapters of a kind of a summary of his work, there's the word syzygy.
Oh, wow.
I about fell out of my chair because I didn't really know what the word was. I just heard the sounds. But then I'm reading and there's this word, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y.
Wow.
And I'm like, whoa, there is one, a collective unconscious that I've tapped into. And syzygy is kind of, I think it's German through a Hungarian root, means the marriage of opposites, or the marriage of the masculine feminine, mm, of masculine and feminine, or a cosmic marriage. And I thought, whoa, and I'd never heard of that word before. So I was, the skeptic and the scientist in me was pretty much cracked open by that experience, because I had no way to explain how this word ended up in my psyche.
Mm-hmm. And your experience here with this, first with this urging to do something different, going on a sabbatical, and then finding yourself in a rite of passage, is so different than our usual modern society's pathway. In fact, rites of passage and initiation are, you could say, a lost art in our modern culture.
Yeah, and, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so wondering, you know, for someone who's listening, what are some, they can hear your story, but what are some other signs that they might be in need of or ready for this experience, like a rite of passage? Because we don't even have, there's just not even a place where someone is like, oh, what you're experiencing is it's time for your rite of passage. It's like, we don't even have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's a couple, maybe a couple things to be said about rite of passage. And there's certainly some other resources on the internet where Bill Plotkin speaks directly to rite of passage and what is the work of most rite of passages and what is the work of the Animas Valley Institute. And one thing I'll say is that rite of passages are typically marking something that's already finished.
Wow.
In a sense. It's in a Healthian culture, you know, rites of passages are that the person has completed whatever task of their life stage, typically adolescence, and that they're ready to move into kind of adulthood. And that's my understanding as well. And because my understanding is our culture is relatively unhealthy in the way that we focus on raising teenagers and adolescents, not to be connected to their emotions, not to be connected to their authenticity. That's sometimes what happens on programs like this. So there are plenty of groups that have rites of passage, a lot of them on the West Coast, actually, and some in the Northeast as well. And I think probably more so in the Southeast coming on now that other people are kind of being exposed to the significance of these works. But rites of passage do a lot of things. They facilitate time in the wild, which is really important. You know, it's kind of like the nature deficit disorder that Richard Louv writes about. So few adolescents and so few children have a lot of time in nature, of just kind of being themselves and exploring nature by themselves and, you know, having a sit spot and spending, you know, some quiet time there for a couple of minutes or hours a day and just kind of dropping into their own connection to the natural world. So that's something that happens on a rite of passage. Typically, one is also surrounded by other individuals who are at different stages of development, who can see more deeply into who you are and help facilitate your further growth. There's also something about just being in a community, and a normative experience of with intent about moving from one stage of life to another. Yeah, and in our culture, you know, I guess rites of passage would be more shallow and surface, but like graduation and promotion.
Yeah.
It would be the rites of passage that we think about. But nothing's really changed there except that your responsibilities and expectations might be different, but you might not have much of a shift of consciousness of who you are and what's really important right now. And that's kind of what my experience was, of kind of graduating through these programs. You know, we go through ceremonies of graduation in medical school and promotions and et cetera. And a lot of that tends to feed the ego, I would say, that you're making your way up the ladder, so to speak, and getting more money and more security, which is probably not actually true in the world.
Gosh, that's great
to
hear.
Security?
Being a musician in my 20s, I'm really happy to hear that. So what happens when someone goes on one of these on a soul-guided wilderness journey into nature, this alternative to promotions and graduations?
Yeah.
That's a deeper rite
of
passage.
A lot of different things. Yeah, I think the intent of the Animas Valley Institute programs and other groups that run these nature-based rite of passages or other kind of wilderness experiences are they're really meant to shift consciousness. They do. And part of it, what happens is related to the readiness of the individual, I would say. How mature are they in both a egoic sense, in terms of their wholeness for emotional experience and being present, and their imagination and their openness to images like dreams and shamanic journeying, deep imagery, different things like that. And also their the intent of the guides is probably an important component as well, since all organizations are and guides are a little bit different in their intent and their understanding of what they're doing.
And I just want to specify here, since on our program we do often talk about spirit guides, here you're talking about actual wilderness people guides, right?
Yeah, and maybe we need a little clarification of what we mean by the wilderness.
Yes, okay, yeah,
please.
Let's do it.
And go also, there. What is it about that wilderness that helps people go to their own soul, place, and purpose? So run with that.
Yeah, so maybe there are two wildernesses, and maybe mm-hmm. they're not that different. Maybe there's the wilderness of what we would call nature, which is kind of, you know, in its best sense, what was described by John Muir, you know, the call of the wilderness and I must go, which is just to get away from culture and back to a place where everything that is there is actually born in some sense. It's not really created by human culture. And everything there is living its purpose in a certain sense, and it's wild, which is from one of the, you know, understandings of that word wild might mean self-willed. It's actually doing what it does on its own from a deeper pattern. So that might be one understanding of wilderness. The other understanding of wilderness might be what's within us deeply, within our own psyche. That our own inner psyche is a deep wilderness, especially places that have been suppressed, and a plus, especially the place of soul encounter, which we would call, in depth psychology language and mythology, the underworld. So maybe I'll also add a couple other things. So spirit guides might be a word that could be used interchangeably to mean many different things. My understanding of the word is it could be a guide to spirit, right? Which could be the non-dual suchness, oneness with everything. It could also be a guide to what we would call your wholeness, your ability to be present and emotionally engaged and connected deeply to your images and to connected to your heart. That could also be maybe some sort of spirit guide. And then there might also be a spirit guide, which is more like a soul guide, which is something that's pointing deeper. So this is kind of based on some indigenous shamanic, Celtic, and a lot of other pan-cultural understandings of the world, that we live in three worlds. That we primarily think we live in this middle world of the ego and our responsibilities to our partners and children and the land and jobs and things like that. And that there's also this upper world, which is the realm of spirit. And what typically gets forgotten in Western culture and in a lot of cultures, especially ones that think they come from heaven, is that there's this underworld place, which is the deeper place of mystery and soul, something like that.
So this underworld and soul, I think... For a lot of people, there's so many different definitions of spirit versus soul. And
ego also.
And yeah. And
indeed.
And so you've kind of outlined a little bit of what you mean by these things. And so take us deeper into the underworld. Like what?
Sure. And yeah. I'll bring back to your question about wilderness. So partly one of the things that we've learned and experienced is that nature is a mirror to soul. Things happen more deeply in nature that mirror deeper aspects of ourself than frequently happen when we're in our busy, civilized life, something like that. So I'll give you an example of an experience I had on the same program that I spoke about, this wilderness journey. A couple of things happen. One of the reasons we do these things in nature is primarily to shift consciousness again, to get away from, you know, Western cultural consciousness, which has a certain pace, obviously, and is frequently connected to technology and to the worries of the day. And when one is out in nature, one's consciousness automatically begins to shift radically, especially after a night in the wild, or as I shared in my story, after a night when a cold windstorm, we have a dream that kind of ends your first life. Yeah. You can sense that my consciousness had already shifted there. And so part of it was just me entering into the wilderness with the intent of and trust that there's something deeper in life, and being met by that, that there's something in the soul of nature that longs for us also to wander back into nature to find our deepest place. So part of that might be an understanding that the point of, in some sense, the in healthy cultures, there's always been a balance between culture and nature. And in Western culture, obviously, we've been devastating nature and seeing nature primarily as a place of extraction, of getting resources to continue building our busy culture, as well as a place maybe of recreation. And for most healthy indigenous cultures, and culturally this is true, it's primarily a place to wander, again, on a rite of passage, going into the dream time, a walkabout or a pilgrimage or, the amblechea, which is the Lakota word for kind of the grief cry or vision quest, which was later described by anthropologists, is that individuals go into the wild to find their deepest place in the world. Bill calls it your eco-psychological niche, N-I-C-H-E. And then once one has an understanding of that's one's place in the world, you return to culture and you become that. And by returning to culture with this new wisdom from the wilderness, the culture becomes renewed and regenerated in a sense and doesn't continue on its same path, something like that. So that's...
We can infiltrate.
Yeah,
we can infiltrate and inform the path of culture by going into the underworld and bringing back some of that energy into our interactions and values and construction of our middle world lives.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think the word visionary, you know, that gets used a lot in our culture now when people have something that's, I guess primarily out here, they use it for disruptive technology. They call themselves visionaries, right? But when I speak of visionary, it comes actually not from one's egoic mind of understanding what it is, but it's actually a vision that one receives on some sort of pilgrimage like this, that one has a dream or a memory or a remembering of one's deeper soul identity. And that comes in Bill's book. You know, he talks about his story where he's also gone through some transition where he's walked away from academics and he's begun exploring Western United States. And he's up on a mountain and he writes so eloquently about it in Soulcraft that, you know, he's at this lake and he notices a butterfly coming toward him. And as it comes toward him, something like pay attention, and it brushes his cheek, and he hears the words cocoon weaver. Mm. That's almost like an auditory vision, right? It's not a visual vision, but an auditory vision of one's deeper place in the world, which is, you know, at first kind of, what is that? It's kind of perplexing and disorienting. And for most individuals who join us on our programs, who, when they're ready and this is their intent for soul encounter and they have something like that, it's enchanting and disorienting and a bit terrifying because they don't really know what it is. It's not like you get a new job description. It's more esoteric. It's more mystical. And it might take, I don't know, anywhere from 6 months to 3 years to kind of move deeper into what this image is and does and moves and powers, and then maybe a lifetime to embody what is asked of it, something like that.
So let's go from you went on your sabbatical and you were in the canyon having this amazing dream that cracked you open. You went to the library a few weeks later and saw that word. And then how did you reintegrate into culture? What did you do in your own life?
Well, it was a bit of a challenge, right? Because I wasn't that interested anymore. Mm-hmm. Returning back to my busy practice.
So you did go back to your practice, though?
I did. I didn't go for long, actually. Mm-hmm. I went back and thought, wow, I was really excited about what I had discovered here, and I was ready for another program. Mm-hmm. And another journey into the wild. And so I would go on my own wanders into nature and began journaling my dreams and reading more poetry, actually, and longing actually for a community of other people who had done something similar, who understand this consciousness. And I couldn't really find it where I was, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And the last dream I had on that first journey was a dream of a long dream, but part of it was one adolescent, I would say, gutting or dismembering another adolescent, which obviously was kind of upsetting.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But not in the way I thought it would be. There was also something exciting about it in the dream. And I got home and got an email from this Animas Valley Institute, and again, and one of the headlines of the emails was, "Is there anyone ready for more dismemberment?"
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, oh, I guess I am ready. Right? So these synchronies. And so I went back to Denver and back to my academic job, and was less attached to it in many ways, obviously, and was beginning to realize that the great guy I thought I was maybe it was just me thinking that. There were other people around me showing me there were places where I was becoming inflated because of my success. And pretty intolerant of people. And I just thought, you know, it was other people's issues. And so I began to really wonder, it's like, man, and, you know, obviously your partners are your best help at this. They're like, you know what? You know what? You think that's my stuff? That's actually your stuff. Mm. So I began looking more in what we would call our shadow parts of ourselves, things that we don't really, that we're not aware of and would typically deny until, you know, several people show it to us. And then after I got that email, I signed up for a vision quest with Animas Valley. And that was in, I think it was in October, maybe 5 years ago. And that was guided by Bill and his partner, Janine Marie Haugen, and went on the vision quest with the intent of, I want to have a soul encounter. I had many powerful experiences in the canyon country of Utah with dream and with images and with creatures. And I had a significant amount of healing. And obviously my consciousness had shifted that maybe my life in some sense was just beginning, actually. This deeper life was just beginning. And I think I was about 44 at the time, 44 or 45. And I went on this vision quest, not knowing anything more than what I'd also read in the book Soulcraft, but really longing to be cracked wide open in some sense, to have a mystical encounter with nature and the cosmos and my own deeper sense of who I am, so that I could actually not really so much serve myself or serve my institution, but serve the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. Something like that. That was my intent.
Your bigger purpose.
And even better, yeah. Imagining a, you know, could there be an intersection of your service to the world and this deep soul calling?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, trying to think of the quote by Frederick Buechner, who's a progressive Christian theologian. It's something like where your heart's deepest gladness and the world's deepest need meet. Something like
love that.
That
one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's kind of like the soul overlap, so to speak. And again, Bill uses ecological terms, the eco-psychological niche. It's where you really fit in, or it's a place that's been waiting for you your whole life to step into. David White, the poet, calls it the largest conversation you can have with the world. That kind of place. Not in a hubristic, egoic sense, but just where you fit and you naturally flow and where you naturally serve. something like that.
I love that ecological perspective too, because each member of an ecological community serves a purpose. And so often we feel that as a sense of place. So just
absolutely
saying I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I think it's a unique perspective and one that I resonated deeply with as well, because the alternative is a culture that's primarily determined by ego, mm-hmm. which is from our own sense of what we think is right. But in our Western culture, it's primarily what's best for me or for my people. And we can see where that's run its course and where it's left us right now, obviously. Yeah, ecology, it's about co-evolution and mm-hmm. filling our own niches, actually. Mm-hmm. Only by us taking our own step into our niche can others find theirs as well.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, along this journey, you're going through this dramatic transformation. You're, you know, changing your whole perspective on life. What's happening between you and your wife? And what did your wife think about all that?
Great question. So she's also trained as a psychiatrist.
Uh-huh.
And
she didn't throw you in the loony bin?
Well, I think she was a little concerned. You know, I think there was a couple of threads here. There was a sense of she liked the fact that I was showing up more authentically and in my emotions. And it's a little unsettling, right? Because when you shift consciousness, well, then your partner has to shift consciousness a little mm-hmm. bit. And that's primarily why couples don't evolve. It's because most couples end up in this, I would say, conspiracy of trying to stay on the same level, so
wow,
to speak.
Wow, beautifully put. Thank you for naming
something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard thing, and it's a challenging thing when one senses it's time for something else. You know, it rocks the boat a bit, and there's kind of unspoken agreements about how individuals are going to be in relationships that may begin to shift. But for me, it's not as important to kind of make sure I'm making money right now or producing or, you know, being complicit in things that I don't like about our relationship anymore. I may actually speak up about those things, and that might rock the boat a bit because I've been quiet about certain things. So mm-hmm. there's those components. And then there's also this other part that I'm actually showing up more as a man who's more grounded in some ways, not necessarily confident, but just grounded and knowing and curious about the world. But you know, when you share stories about being held by a grandfather juniper for 12 hours, mm-hmm. and it's a little different than what you expect your partner to share, perhaps, or having conversations with wild beings or weeping, you know, for a couple hours on the land, it's a little like, what's going on with my partner? And again, when you have your own consciousness shifts, you can't really understand it until yours does as well.
Mm. So where are y'all at with that now? Like, was there anything that she went through concurrently with you or?
A little bit. She started reading Soulcraft mm-hmm. and I think got to the point where it was like, and sometimes you may have to jettison parts of your life that no longer serve. And I think that frightened her, actually. She wasn't ready to jettison parts of her life. And got to the point after the vision quest where I think she was thinking like, you know, what's going on with you? Worried, frightened, and concerned. And I said, well, why don't you go out for a weekend? You know, and I gave her some time. We had two young kids at the time. Why don't you go out for a weekend and just start talking to the wild and see what happens. Something happened. And she goes, okay, maybe there's something to this. And then I said, well, why don't you go on a journey yourself? And she's like, well, you said that first journey. It was like 37 degrees and raining. I have no interest in sleeping on the ground in conditions.
Not a hard sell there.
No. And she said, on the other one, then you fasted for 4 days on their vision fast. I have no interest in fasting. I'm already tiny, and I would probably get hypoglycemic and die. And she said, and I said, well, what if there was a warm place like Hawaii? And she said, oh, I would do something like that. So they actually had one in Costa Rica. And so I said, well, I'll watch the kids for those week and a half. You want to go? And she went and had a great time. Also had pretty unique experiences with the land and dream, and fell in love with Costa Rica and came back, I would say, enchanted with nature and her own life in a certain way. So it also had a very similar, she had very similar kind of opening to what the world could be once we get away from what we typically think the world is, something like that.
Very cool that you brought that medicine to your family that way.
Yeah. And so it was not long thereafter when it was time for me to, or I realized that I was not necessarily called to be a psychiatrist in this world, that that was meant for me to get some skills and some perspectives and the ability to kind of build something. But that I was really here actually as what we would call a nature-based guide to soul, a soul guide. And that not something that's really, would be the right word.
There's no college program for it.
There's not necessarily a college program. And it's also, it's almost like a divorce, the irreconcilable differences between my worldview with myself first, but then also with, you know, academic psychiatry. So there's no way I couldn't imagine figuring how to do that. And I don't think they really were interested in having me further once I began to differentiate out further into what I thought I was and the world was. So I think I lost.
You didn't fit into that box anymore.
Yeah, and I had my own work to do on, part of the other thing about this underworld journey is it's a humbling process. Humbling in the best sense in terms of it returns you to earth, which is humus, earth, dirt. And that by kind of humbling oneself and moving vulnerably into the underworld and submitting to all the psychic energies and the cosmic energies and the poetry and the mythos of that place, one, the ego is defeated in many ways. It just, it submits and it no longer thinks that it's in charge of doing things in the world, but that it takes its, in a sense, marching orders from soul, but it's not really marching. It's really a sacred marriage. And one of the best descriptions I like is that one that Bill has about ego and soul is that the ego knows how to manifest in the world, but doesn't know what's worth manifesting. Soul knows what's worth manifesting, but doesn't know how to manifest.
Beautifully put.
Yeah, and so when I read that, and I think maybe he even spoke that, I was like, oh, so that's kind of the point of the first part of my life. It actually wasn't a waste to be a psychiatrist and to be an academician and a writer, but it was more kind of building that first house so that it could crumble, so that I could find this deeper underground cavern where now I know what's worth doing in the world, which actually helps maybe, in a sense, tear down the culture. In a sense, help it die so that we can actually have a culture that actually supports a more soul-centric education and soul-centric religion and soul-centric medicine and psychotherapy, not so much focused on only the ego and trying to keep the ego going and keeping it healthy.
So I just want to give you like a virtual high five.
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe what you guys are doing as well, and what your friend who runs the farm is doing.
Yeah, it's everywhere. The gods and goddesses. Yeah. So this first house you built, this sort of first personality crumbles, and you have a new encounter between your ego and soul. You've told us a little bit about the relationship between ego and soul, but for our listeners, can you unpack a little bit of Bill's language around ego and how it can serve the soul? It can support soul embodiment when it's mature. What does it look like to have a mature ego?
That's a great question. Maybe there's a couple levels of ego here that are worth talking about.
Go for it.
So ego loves
it. We don't necessarily think of in a bad sense. Ego is something that every child develops and needs to develop, actually. So that's one of the tasks of the first stage of life is to develop an ego that functions pretty well, which is why early childhood is so important in terms of attuned parenting and attachment and all those different things that I was doing in my original practice. It's really important to have that because when one does not have a well-fashioned ego, disturbances can occur and can occur early. So in most best sense, everyone, you know, the majority of the population, at least in our culture, probably develop a relatively functional ego, but it's not a mature ego. And in Bill's book, Wild Mind, he talks about how do you create a more mature ego. And the one way that he models it is that he has a map called the nature-based map of the human psyche, which shows that there are facets of our whole ego that rarely get cultivated in Western culture. And this is the ability to be, there's four of them, and they have different ways of knowing. And one of them is the way of knowing of just kind of sensory perception and being present. And he places this on his map in the East, which makes sense based on what happens in the East in terms of new beginnings and dawn. And the way of knowing there is the sensory way. And he has specific archetypes that he describes, and one can certainly read about those in his book or see it on the Wild Mind book website. And so it, being present and in one's senses is something that doesn't happen for most children, actually. If you think about most children and adolescents, they're not in one's senses. They might be in the visual sense and looking at their cell phone or an iPad, something like
that.
Yeah,
but for the most part, they're just kind of bopping around, forgetting things. You know, I know I was. Losing my glasses and leaving muddy stains on the ground all the time. And that's pretty common.
I think that's where mindfulness and other meditative practices, no matter what tradition they come from, are very helpful. They're practices to help just be present to what is, actually. And doing that in nature is also pretty amazing as well. For people who've meditated in nature, it's a very different experience from doing it in a studio or on a cushion or something. Another way to mature the ego is to cultivate what he calls the archetype of the wild indigenous one, the one that knows that they're primarily connected to the earth and their home in every emotion and in their bodies. They sense these emotions in their bodies too. And in our culture, most people try and push away emotion or medicate emotion away, and it's not fully metabolized or experienced for the gifts that it tells you about what happened and what does that mean for me? What do I value? So there's not a lot of emotional intelligence, typically. Again, that's changing with some of the shifts in the culture, and, you know, kind of mindfulness has re-entered into the, or has entered into the cultural language in some progressive institutions. Same thing with emotional intelligence and also with authentic movement. All these practices are to help us return to our presence and our emotions and our bodies. And then in the, another way of knowing, so there's the being present and in one's senses and being connected to one's body and emotions. Another way of knowing is through thought. And the way that he describes it is he calls it heart-centered thinking, and it is the gift of the nurturing generative adult who actually thinks from the heart, not necessarily, again, about oneself, but about the greater ecological community and the more than human world and seven generations down the line, rather than just for me and mine right now. And then the fourth facet of cultivating, worth cultivating to get a whole mature ego, is one that the way of knowing is the imaginal way. And this is probably the most suppressed in our culture. I would say kind of the emotional bodily is suppressed, and also the imaginal is suppressed. If you think about phrases in our culture, like it's just your imagination, how that really just slams this way of knowing. Yeah. And unfortunately, artists know that this is the way.
Yes.
Poets know this is the way, and depth psychologists know that this is the way. And this is also the way into soul. But to go back to your question, most of us end up with an immature ego, which in his book, Wild Mind, he also describes that we operate from our fragments. And these might be from voices that seem like an inner critic or one that's wounded or our addict self, something like that, that he also places in the four directions. And part of the goal of maturing is for these places to be honored for how they protected us when we were younger, but no longer serve, that our immature egos, we needed to survive, in some sense, what we call the war of childhood, where it's risky in an unhealthy culture, and you need defensive strategies to survive.
I just want to say, I've never heard anyone say the war of childhood, and it's, I just want to bookmark it, because we've talked with so many guests and so many people about childhood is a time that really does have that energy of war. And I apologize for interrupting you.
No, I'm glad you did.
You caught me.
Yeah, I think, you know, in our culture, we're not necessarily aware of this, but this is what psychotherapy primarily focuses on, right? It's what happened to me, traumatic and otherwise, through my experiences in my family and my educational and my religious system. And that's important. We do need, you know, psychiatry does have a place. Medics, psychopharmaceuticals have a place in our culture. And psychotherapy definitely has a place in our culture to help people first experience some of these emotions that they're trying to keep away and safe, and also for someone to hold models of wholeness for which they can actually eventually cultivate themselves. But I think that often gets lost in modern psychotherapy, where the whole focus is on, you know, the relationship or on strategies, and not necessarily focusing on cultivating one's own ability to deal with one's own issues. Mm. Bill's model is that you first cultivate wholeness in these four areas, and there's lots of suggestions on how to do it, many in nature. And then once you've cultivated your wholeness, is then you begin to explore your childhood survival strategies, these fragments, and learn how they work and how they've saved you, and to acknowledge them and to love them, and then to almost begin releasing them a little bit so that they don't have to run the show so much.
And one of them was one of them was the obedient soldier, right?
The loyal soldier.
Love the loyal soldier. Can you go into that a little bit, what the loyal soldier is? Because I think a lot of people kind of get stuck there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and loyal soldier is very helpful. The loyal soldier is usually comes in three voices. One is the inner critic, which we all know. You're not good enough. You don't look good enough. They wouldn't want you. You're not capable of that. Who do you think you are? Something like that. There's also the lion tamer, which is like, really? That big of a dream? No, certainly not for you. It's a version of the inner critic in some ways. And then there's one that's also there, which is the inner flatterer, which for people who are successful in our unhealthy Western culture is maybe a tougher one to acknowledge and to let go of. It's the one that says, you know, if you left this, everything would fall apart.
Oh, wow.
No one can do this like you can do it.
Yeah.
Right. And all three of those voices help us stay small, safe, secure, and also a place from not entering into our deeper story. What else? And they all developed in childhood so that we don't feel like we are ever abandoned. We develop these strategies so that those around us don't orphan us in some ways for what we're bringing out, what's coming uniquely from us, or even from parts of ourselves that aren't necessarily nice, that we don't get abandoned. We develop these strategies of kind of hiding what's authentic to us and what our longings are and our emotions, all those different kind of things.
Those
and then we
big
end up
dreams.
Kind of living them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then they just kind of run the show, and we're not really aware of them until most people never become aware of them, I would say. They think that's who they are, and there is no other way.
Mm-hmm. And so if anyone's listening, they're like, oh my gosh, then I definitely recommend you read Soulcraft, because this will lay it out for you
and help you with strategies to encounter the loyal soldier and other sub personalities and honor them and allow you to move on from that energy and integrate it.
Yeah, I'd say Soulcraft is a good start. Also, it's more this is further elaborated on in Bill's latest book, which is called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche, where he really goes through this nature-based model of the human psyche, and really describes soul, spirit, ego, all these different things that I've been talking about in the last maybe 15 minutes, these different parts of our personality and ourself that help us to function. But when we get to the point where we're being called to the deeper story, we need to let go of them a little bit. We need to actually honor the loyal soldier, praise them, and kind of give them a retirement party when it's ready, so that we can actually move towards something that is unknowable right then. And partly that's what our ego likes to do, is to keep us safe and not move towards so much uncertainty. And partly, you know, the ego, I think, has a sense that I talked earlier about it, the decisive defeat of the ego, which is at soul encounter and soul embodiment afterward, soul initiation, is that the ego wants to keep going because it's done a great job and it doesn't necessarily know that you can survive what's going to happen next.
And so can you, so we go through this like ego death and we rediscover some sort of guidance about what our true purpose is. And then we try to reintegrate into society by bringing our soul gifts. So just to be really clear, like in this day and age, is it possible to do this within our society?
Yeah, good question. Let me finish up a thought from the previous question, which is related. Yeah, so we talk about, so there's the immature ego, then there's the mature ego, which has cultivated wholeness and done some self-healing. And typically what happens also during this part is probably what's happened for, I would imagine, you and other of your friends, is there's an eco-awakening where you begin to sense that this world is not so much necessarily about me. Actually, it's more about how, what I can contribute to my land base and my local community and being part of other things, maybe other global movements. Something like that. So that typically also happens during this place of moving toward a more mature ego. And then there tends to be a stage of development that requires a severance from understanding what one knows one is. And this is moving into what Bill would call one's second adolescence, or wandering into the cocoon. And this is the place that he talks about in Soulcraft, where you're wandering into the mysteries of nature and psyche. And what happens there when one wanders in wholeness and intent and longs for soul encounter is that one is frequently met by some sort of decisive defeat of the ego, which means that first life is kind of over, you know, in a sense, it's over in terms of the direction that it lives in. And after further exploration through Soulcraft practices, which he writes about in Soulcraft, obviously, and through mentoring sometimes and other conversations and just beginning to live some of the questions of soul and moving more fully, authentically, not from the ego's place, but what would soul do? Something like that. What would my new identity do? One gets to a place... what the Bill describes is soul initiation, where he uses the phrase again from the wonderful poet David White, you make a vow it would kill you to break, where the rest of your life forward isn't so much about safety and security and blazing your own trail. It's really about embodying this soul image and gifts and powers and service to the world. And that typically is another stage of development where one is learning from others who have already done this, how to do this. And it's like an apprenticeship, actually. And you're continually going back into the soul stream, so to speak, to get more encounters and understanding and a deeper intuition of what one is asked to do. And it might mean more training, per se. So I had to retrain as a psycho-spiritual wilderness guide with Animus and learn how to guide people to wholeness and self-healing and on the underworld journey. I also had to learn lots of other wilderness skills. I'm also learning a lot more about writing, because that was something else I found on the underworld journey, which is that I'm really called to write about this journey in a couple of different ways. But I was trained as a medical writer, which is really boring to read. Actually, maybe not so inviting as creative nonfiction or fiction or poetry has as the ability to guide others to this place.
You actually have a poetry book coming out, don't you?
Hopefully soon. Yeah. Cool.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's what one explores in these places. And I'll just share on my vision quest, the preparation was challenging and a heart opening, and I knew my intent. And on my 4 days in the wild, I wrote 200 pages.
Wow.
Wow.
Some stories, probably about 30 poems, lots of dreams. And even though I hadn't eaten, I felt more alive than I had my entire life, actually. There was just a unique vitality that I've not actually experienced since.
That's
interesting.
And so there's
something about being in that space and vulnerable to the wild that these things that have been waiting to speak have space to speak.
Mm.
So that's kind of that stage of wandering in the mysteries of nature and psyche. And to your question is, it's not immediate. It's not like a weekend program where, oh, now I know what I'm here to do.
Makeover.
And I go back and do it. There are those things which Bill calls, in his metaphor and kind of images of the caterpillar and the butterfly, is that we frequently go through molts, just like a caterpillar goes through three or four shifts where it outgrows its current skin and grows a new skin that allows it to get bigger and bigger. And then it grows another skin and it sheds that one. And then eventually it gets to this place in its life cycle, just as we do, where no longer it's about getting a bigger skin or maybe another promotion or a better car or something. It becomes dying, really. And the caterpillar doesn't really know what's happening, but it kind of intuitively creates this chrysalis, and it moves into the chrysalis, this cocoon, and it really dies to itself. It's no longer a caterpillar, and it becomes caterpillar soup, shit.
And there are things called imaginal cells in that caterpillar soup, which I always found really interesting. And to hear that Bill's using the imaginal realm as, I picture it sitting in the north in the sort of map of the wild psyche.
Mm-hmm.
That's neat.
Yeah, and so there are these cells that take everything that's happened to the caterpillar before, but it's deeper in its DNA. And it ends up becoming the butterfly or the imago, which is like the final image. And it's the same with us. I like that image and that one. I also feel it's the one that's more relevant for me is actually like the journey of the salmon. Mm. The salmon is not really a salmon if it's stuck in a lake behind a dam. Mm. It's a salmon when it journeys all the way down to the ocean, eats different food, and returns in the second half of its life, offering itself basically to the greater ecology of where it came from.
And this ethos of offering, offering your own sacred gifts, discovering your a sense of soul and embodying that in service to the world really pervades a lot of what I've read in Soulcraft.
Yeah, I think that's the primary understanding of Bill and of the Animas Valley Institute and of healthy indigenous cultures and other cultures that are becoming healthy is that in some sense we were born in this lifetime with a cosmic debt, actually, which is to fulfill our soul purpose, S-O-U-L, which doesn't, again, come from the ego, but it's from this greater imaginal world. And we can't really find it until we've matured enough and hold enough and then descended to the underworld and encountered what it is, which is disorienting and wonderful and mysterious. And it takes a while to kind of understand what other skills and perspectives and things I might need. And then it begins to come back and begin serving. And part of that is it needs a like a vehicle. So what vehicle can I bring this mystical image and powers back to my culture with? And for some, it's as a writer. For some, it could be as a teacher. For some, we have many psychotherapists who return as psychotherapists as their primary vehicle, but they're doing something very different now. They are doing it both in practice and also the place of what they're doing is different. We have pastors who also do this work and who go on these things, and you know, they realize that in some sense they thought they were serving something that was spiritual, but they had really never encountered the deep sacred of themselves or of the world or of the universe. And so they return in a different way. How then do I serve now, knowing what I know and knowing about myself, who I am, and what the world is? And it's a bit challenging, and it takes a little bit of time. And my own experience with this, it's kind of like, I'll also go back to the salmon image. Like, if you ever watch salmon, when they get back to land, they're a little disoriented. They're not quite sure which is their home stream yet. They have to sniff around a little bit and use those great cells that they have in their olfactory organ to kind of figure out, is this my home stream? Is this my people? Is this where I'm asked to return to and serve? And it may take a while.
Yeah, so always holding space for discernment and transition.
And I think one thing that also could be helpful is just knowing that, you know, to continue in one's previous life might be a way of inauthentic success, and that the time now, even authentic failures might serve.
Oh, yeah. I would take an authentic failure over an inauthentic success.
Yeah,
I hope. I say like now.
Yeah, you feel like, well, this is maybe a place where I could serve. This could be my people. This could be my vehicle. And then finding out, okay, well, maybe no one shows up in a certain way, or maybe it doesn't work, or maybe my expectations are wrong. Mm-hmm. And then to kind of grieve that, try again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So we've talked a lot about this, this process. I love your salmon analogy, and if someone wants to learn more about you and about what you offer, where can they find you? And tell us a little bit about what you offer.
Sure. So I no longer practice medicine. So if you want to see me as a psychiatrist, you're out of luck. Fortunately, there are plenty of good psychiatrists who do that. I do this work with a lot of colleagues, actually. And if you're not in Southern California, which I'm sure the majority of you are not, I would go to the Animas Valley Institute website, which is www.animas.org. Animas also means soul in Spanish and Latin. And that's the primary site of the work that I do with Bill Plotkin and about 10 other guides. And we run these types of programs, probably about 35 programs a year, across the country, and also in England and Canada, and this year also in Colombia and Australia. So that would be a good reference for if you want to actually go on immersion. If you want to read more about this, obviously a good place to start is if you're really curious about this underworld journey and this deeper place of belonging and the soulcraft practices and the enchantment of the earth in your life, I would read Soulcraft by Bill Plotkin. And if you're more interested in the preparatory work, which is the wholing, self-healing, maturing ego work done in nature, I would read Wild Mind by Bill. And if you're interested in more in terms of how do I create soul-centric community, education, systems, Bill's kind of magnum opus is Nature and the Human Soul, which is a fabulous book that really describes his 8-stage model of the journey to soul encounter and soul realization in the world and what we can do about it in these different avenues in our culture. So those would be good resources. And if you're in Southern California, you could contact me. My website is eco-psyche-artistry.com, or you could just look up my name and find it. And if you're a healthcare provider, I also guide healthcare providers into this work, and that's one of the places I'm moving to right now. This is also something I discovered on my own journey, is that although I thought I was leaving medicine for good, I'm being asked to serve medicine in a very different way, and which is not surprising, I guess, is that many of the experiences we have in the first half of our life and the people we meet and the places and ways that we serve, we're asked to serve differently in the second half of life. But we already have a knowing of that area and a credibility in some sense and relationships and connections. And so I have a website and programs that are called wildernessismedicine.org. And we run programs around the United States as well this year.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing. And if someone's interested in your poetry, I guess you'll be releasing that information. Do you have a newsletter people could sign up for? Or
yeah, there's some on the website, and then more and more will be on my Facebook page as well.
Okay, cool. And we'll link to all of these in our show notes too. So awesome. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your work and the work of Bill, and just, you know, opening up this world in a different way for our listeners. It's been really a pleasure to get to talk to you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to hear your questions and your curiosity and your reflections. And maybe one thing for everyone there, if anyone's listening, is maybe an invitation tonight actually would be to long for a dream, actually, that might begin to shift your own current of your life.
I love it.
I think, when we are feeling into the longing that we have to know our deeper place in the world, especially now, our world feels like such a disaster in so many different avenues, and we long for it to be really connected and serving rather than fragmented and destructive the way it is that really feel into that place of, what if the world could be that way? What if I am that way? What if I could actually be an agent toward rewilding myself in the world? What image or dream would help me? And almost feel like an opening toward that. And keep a pen and a pad of paper handy. And if a dream comes, write it down.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Sure. Well, then, you know, we'll hopefully get to speak to you again soon about some more of those types of exercises and things you can do. I love the dream work stuff. But until then, many blessings, and, you know, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we can't wait to bring you something new next week. But in the meantime, if you are interested in learning about how to align your actions, your thoughts, and your feelings with the ability to embody and express that true essence of who you are and what you came here to be, then I invite you to take this free 7-day manifesting challenge that I've set up for y'all. It's at dreamfreedombeauty.com/manifest. You can sign up there. And if you've heard of manifesting before and been like, ooh, that's like trying to force the universe to work to your will. Well, that's not what I'm talking about here. Sure, that's been used plenty in law of attraction and manifesting, you know, teachings, but really what it's about to me and what I teach is manifesting is about aligning your will with divine will. It's about tapping into that feeling of what your essence is, of like what you came here to embody and express, and working from that point outwards to create a life that is supported by that and that supports that in return, rather than trying to fit yourself into some sort of box and trying to like keep denying that truth of who you are and of what you want to be. And so I teach this manifesting. I teach you some really practical step-by-step stuff. I give you some exercises to start tapping into that. And I also teach you how to help this process, help this learning and understanding by connecting with nature more deeply. And one thing I teach is how you can tap into the cycles, your personal cycles of creativity, of energy, of tiredness of needing rest, and how you can learn from the cycles of nature, and how you can tap into your favorite cycles in nature, the ones that feel most attractive to you, and learn from them to then reflect that back into your own life about how you can more closely work with the true cycles of your body and of your creative expression and of your inner nature. And I really believe that we don't have to fight against this. We've all been subject to these ideas from society that we have to always produce. And it's just not true. It's like, you know, and so many people have been driven to the edge of adrenal fatigue and even burnout. I know I was suffering from adrenal burnout a few years ago. For many years I was in adrenal burnout until I finally got some help. And, you know, it was stemmed from one of the biggest things that helped me get over it was, one, if you have this, go to bed by 10 p.m. And two is stepping outside of that need to fit yourself into society's box and really stepping into the ability to embody and express your true essence, and to trust that and to value that and to learn how to let that guide you as you create and express yourself in the world. So if you're interested in that, then head on over to dreamfreedombeauty.com/manifest and sign up, and I will see you there. And you know, I love hearing your questions and helping you. And if you've already emailed me, then you know that I will email you back with an answer. And it just brings me so much joy to be able to help share and spread this message, because I really, truly believe that there's the opportunity for everyone who wants to start embodying this and living this way, guided by their inner essence, rather than trying to fit themselves into society's box. I mean, that time is like over, y'all. You don't need to do that anymore. And I'm here to tell you, like, hey, welcome to this other side. Here are some options. Here's how you do it step by step, kind of like the Martha Stewart of the new paradigm. Like, here's how you can decorate your life. But it's like, here's how you can decorate your life through manifesting from that place of your inner essence and truth and beauty and like connection with nature and connection with each other. And there's so much beauty to be had. And so this drives me to embody this in my own life and to share it with y'all and to just keep uplifting all of us in this journey as we discover what it means to be aligned with each other, with our truth, with the earth, and to create this new world. So I'm so grateful for all of you. And if you're interested in that, again, it's dreamfreedombeauty.com/manifest, and feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you. I love talking with you. I love hearing your questions and your successes and all that. So much love, and I'll see you there. Mwah.